In order to begin to understand the Black Hills, you need to spend some time there. For me, the forest sounds a little different every time I visit. It's muffled once and ringing the next. One time, I sat in silence for an hour or more and never heard another footstep. Other times, I've been in the Black Hills and heard rustling and rumbling, even a disquiet. But the forest always seems to smell exactly like I remember it does, sweet and fragrant and blanketed with pine. Well, the story of this place is a complicated one, so hold on for the ride today. We're going to begin at a beginning with an origin story. Here's Daryl Redcloud. He's an interpreter at Crazy Horse Memorial in Custer. I asked him to tell me the story of the Great Race, which takes place on the so-called racetrack, which is this reddish ring-shaped depression that surrounds the interior of the Black Hills. Here's Daryl Redcloud.
Our people, they go back and they say that our origin story, they say we come from the great spiritual realm into this spiritual realm within the Black Hills through a place called Wind Cave. Onia Waka, they say in our language. And there they say that everything existed in harmony with one another, all the animals and the beings of different kinds, including mankind. And there was a great race that happened around the Black Hills, and everything ran on the black on this great racetrack, and to see who was going to become the dominant species. And all the animals, the insects of different kinds, the winged, the two-legged, even the four-legged, the pawed, the hoofed animals, they all ran on this great racetrack all the way around. And as they were coming to the end, and then the buffalo was in lead, very strong. And just as he was ready to cross the line, they say that the magpie that sat on his hump behind his ear flew across the line and won the race for the two-legged and the winged. And after everything settled down, then the magpie called upon mankind. "Mankind, we would like to honor you today to become the dominant species to walk upon Mother Earth. Since you have a bigger brain than we do, since you understand Creator's way about his spiritual place, that we must exist in harmony with all of creation." So mankind steps up and he takes that honor. From then on, mankind became the dominant species to walk upon Mother Earth.
Now, we're going to jump forward to the beginnings of the United States of America, not long before gold is discovered and exploited within the Black Hills. What was then referred to popularly as the Great Sioux Nation is the dominant tribe of the Black Hills. Craig Howe is founder and director of the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies. Here he is explaining some key points of U.S. Supreme Court cases and treaties that impacted the Black Hills and the Native people who live there.
The first one basically said that American Indians have occupancy rights to the land, but they don't really own it. The analog I use is just like a deer or a bear or an elk. You know, they occupy the land, but they cannot alienate it in and of themselves. They can't pass it on, and they have no ownership claim to it. That's essentially what the United States decision in 1823 said. And that if American Indians want to alienate their rights to that land in any way, the only entity they can do that to is the United States of America. So it limited the leverage or the negotiating power of American Indians. They didn't have this way of playing the United States off against other nations in the world as far as bidding for land or with states or with individual Americans. That all that was prohibited. Tribes could only alienate their land to the United States. In the 1832 decision, that's where the decision was made that American Indian tribes have inherent rights. Mm. So these are the rights of these tribes and their citizens prior to the United States. These are inherent rights. They're not given to tribes. And so by 1832, then U.S. law recognizes that these tribes have these inherent rights prior to the establishment of the United States and not given to them by the United States. So the first treaty then that Lakotas or the Sioux Nation signed was in 1851, and that was the first Fort Laramie Treaty. And that treaty was basically a treaty of friendship between Plains tribes. And the United States was just trying to get everyone to get along, right? But what they did do was demarcate the territories of these tribes. And so in that 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, the Black Hills are entirely within the lands of the Great Sioux Nation, or Lakotas, as we would say today. 17 years later, there's the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, and those lands are expanded. The lands, and in this case, it's not a treaty of friendship between tribes. It's a treaty of between the United States and the Great Sioux Nation. And the United States essentially is suing for peace. They want the fighting between the United States and the Sioux Nation to end, and so they essentially sue for peace and then agree to all of the terms that the Sioux Nation, mostly represented by Lakotas, demanded. 1868 treaty lands had three statuses. There was the Great Sioux Reservation, there was the unceded territory, and then there was the hunting territory. Those are three land statuses that are encompassed or contained in that 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. And the Black Hills falls entirely within the Great Sioux Reservation.
Jump forward with me again. The Black Hills belongs, if you will, to Native people who use that forest for everything from food and water to ceremony and solace. European American explorers discover gold in the hills, and a great surge of prospectors and settlers and entrepreneurs floods into the land, ignoring treaties and boundaries. They extract gold and minerals. They take land and timber. Lots of timber. There's a real risk of permanent deforestation. Bill Coburn is from Spearfish, and he spent about 50 years in forestry, and here he is explaining that crisis and how the federal government's first timber sale happened.
After gold was discovered, you know, we had anywhere from 20 to 50,000 people descend into the Black Hills in the mid-1870s, and they were using wood for a lot of different things. And they pretty much, between 1876 and about the mid-1890s, late, you know, 1897, they figured over 1 billion board feet of timber was harvested out of the Black Hills. There's a lot of concern in the 1890s about deforestation, rampant logging. There wasn't any coal in the Black Hills, so a lot of these smelters that were being run to smelt gold down and ore were using wood. And so wood was being cut not only for timbers in the mines, but also railroad ties and fuel, and the smelters used probably the most of the timber to basically smelt the ore down to where they could get the gold out. And so in 1897, the president of the United States declared the non-patented lands of the Black Hills as a forest reserve. And that was supposed to put all these areas offline for being mined or logged or anything. Well, it created quite a furor. And so between 1897 and 1898, there was an act passed by the U.S. Congress called the Organic Act, and it basically allowed the forest reserves and the Department of Interior to sell timber off of these federal reserves. And that's where the case number one came into being, down by Nemo, Gifford Pinchot, who was working as an advisor to the Department of Interior, helped put this timber sale together, and they got it sold to Homestake Mining Company. It was for about 15 million board feet, and that was the beginning of timber sales for the National Forest. And then in about 1905, the Forest Reserves became the National Forest, and we ended up with the Black Hills National Forest.
Another big jump on our tour of history today. Let's look at what's happening right now, because many forest lovers believe we are once again at a pivotal crossroads. The Black Hills National Forest, the origin of the Lakota people, the origin of the United States' first federal government timber sale, and the origin of today's story, that forest has changed, and we have changed it. Massive wildfires like the 2001 Jasper Fire and the most recent pine beetle epidemic have also shifted the nature of the forest itself. Here is Jim Furnish. He's the former chief deputy of the U.S. Forest Service.
I'd start by saying I was a little shocked to learn that in 2019, the Black Hills National Forest, out of 150 national forests nationwide, harvested more timber than any other in the U.S. That was mind-blowing to me. This is not the Pacific Northwest. It's good timber country, but that made me think, what's going on? It was one of the reasons I think we, with the Trump administration, where we saw such a focus on trying to restore commercial utilization of a lot of our natural resources. People think of oil and gas and logging, and that type of thing is emblematic of that. But there was something happening on the Black Hills that really caught my attention, and was just shocked to see some of the timber harvesting practices that were occurring there recently. The Forest Service, thankfully, a research branch, completed this general technical report that took a whole look at what was the volume of timber, how much harvesting was going on, what was happening with things like fires in the Black Hills, the bark beetle epidemic, and all this kind of thing, to reach the general conclusion that the logging that was occurring now is simply unsustainable. And I'm talking like magnitudes of three times as much. So they've been harvesting up to 200,000 100 cubic feet. And the general technical report said that they needed to be like at 60,000 or less to be really sustainable. And my thought was that 60,000 level is really returning the Black Hills more to the type of logging when I was there, and more recently, even in the 1990s and that type of thing. So what had stimulated this huge ramp up? And a lot of it was associated with salvage logging of some fires and also the bug mortality. They were harvesting dead trees, but they were also very aggressively mining the green timber, the live standing timber. And then to see the way in which they were doing it with these huge overstory removals where they were taking out all the biggest trees and this kind of thing, I just thought, you know, this requires some response, some action on my part.
Let's talk about that Rocky Mountain Research Station General Technical Report. Well, in it, the scientists say that logging should be reduced by at least 50% in the Black Hills National Forest for the next several decades. The U.S. Forest Service is in the process of revising the current forest plan. The very idea of a reduction in logging, however, is controversial. Existing Forest Service logging restrictions have compelled Neiman Enterprises to close one of its three Black Hills sawmills, according to the company. That cost 120 jobs. The industry says it also reduces the ability of the Forest Service to manage the forest in the future. Here's Bill Coburn again.
In 2000, we had a fire, Jasper Fire, that burned 83,000 acres. In 2002, we had the Battle Creek Fire, 13,000 acres. We had the Grizzly Gulch Fire that burned well over 10,000 acres. And we had a lot of other fires that started basically taking out all these heavily stocked stands of forest. Mm-hmm. And the forest will not stay intact when it's overstocked. And you're going to see it either through natural processes like mountain pine beetle, other types of insects, disease, or fire, it'll start reducing those stocking levels.
Coburn also says the debate over logging recommendations is political and sometimes personal.
you know, I guess there's some differences of opinion, but what I really don't like right now, what's happening, Laurie, is that there are some who are trying to portray the industry as evil and wanting more and more. I know the industry. I worked in it for, you know, 50 years, basically. I started working for it out of high school, and very caring people wanting to make sure what they're doing is sustainable for a long, long time, and they're not looking to over-harvest this forest by any means.
So here's what's at stake. If you harvest too much or you manage the forest poorly, you can destroy the diversity of the forest. You can even deplete the forest. If you harvest too little or you manage the forest poorly, you can create conditions for greater wildfires or further beetle outbreaks, and you can deplete the forest. Now, a working group for the Black Hills National Forest Advisory Board spent months poring over data from researchers in order to recommend sustainable logging levels for the next 5 years, while the Forest Service works on a new, longer-term master plan. That working group sent forward a recommendation that disagreed with the scientists' call for a reduction in logging and instead called for an increase of the cut. Two working group members gave a dissenting presentation, Carissa Bussey of the Nature Conservancy and our next guest, Bob Burns, with the South Dakota Family Forest Association. Burns says now is the time to pause and use caution, both in our actions and in our words.
Well, I would wish some of the entities would not be so vocal in public in their arguments. I really think this is something that we need to leave to the Forest Service and not be it a political basketball being thrown back and forth. The Forest Service is going to go through their plan. They'll get public input for the forest revision, and I think we need to wait and see how that turns out. Certainly everyone has a right to have input, and that's perfectly correct. It kind of gets to the point where you're drawing lines and positions are taken that may not be the best, I guess you would say. One side says we have to go high, one side says we have to go low, but we need people, I think, of moderation that need to find the right answer. And things can change with another fire and another beetle outbreak.
Meanwhile, the forest has changed. The climate has changed. The way we talk to one another has changed. Still, we strive to compromise, to understand, to take this responsibility seriously as we grow toward an uncertain future. Public input on the current forest plan revision continues. We'll continue covering this story as well. You can find all our Spotlight coverage online at sdpb.org/spotlight. If you have more you want to add to the story, send me an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org.